This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
There's some antitrust law coming up, a little bit of housing policy, also some IKEA furniture from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 19th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to do a little catch-up here to start the program, where things stand at week 7 of the AT&T Time Warner trial. To refresh your memories, since 7 weeks is now officially an eternity, AT&T, which owns a lot of content distribution pipes, if you will, wants to spend $85 billion to buy Time Warner, which owns CNN, HBO, and a bunch of other content companies. The Justice Department says, oh, no, you are not, because anti-competitive. Today was AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson's turn on the witness stand. The government's already had a chance to make its case. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath reviews the big issues and reminds us what's at stake.
Let's say you're 35 years old. You don't own a television and you've never had a cable TV subscription.
You're not alone. There are tens of millions of you out there, and that's why the cable industry is never going to recover.
That's the prevailing wisdom, delivered here by Porter Bibb of MediaTek Capital Partners. He says the whole market is obviously transitioning to digital. The Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Googles of the world own the future, and advertisers understand this.
Streaming advertising revenue is jumping 25-35% a year, while it's declining in traditional media and cable.
AT&T and Comcast and Verizon and all the rest of the communications companies that we all grew up with need to expand and to transform themselves.
To be able to compete, says telecom analyst Jeff Kagan, and AT&T in court today. The U.S. Justice Department didn't get back to us, but here's Jeff Bergmeier of the consumer advocacy group Public Knowledge.
We think that this merger would ultimately raise prices for consumers while reducing competition.
Even if they don't outright raise prices, there's other ways a merged AT&T Time Warner could make things difficult for their competitors, giving you a better deal on your HBO package if you buy internet from them, for example. The details of the case can get pretty complicated, says Bergmeier, and
it's just a matter of who tells the more convincing story.
Because this is a bench trial, and the final decision will rest with just one judge. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
We're going to take a turn to the labor force now. In the context of the biggest private employer in this economy, Walmart is trying something new to, in theory, make it a more attractive place to work in a tight labor market. It's going to let workers on the store floors wear jeans, the latest in a long line of relaxed corporate dress codes. From WESA Marketplace's Erica Barris looks into how much of a draw that might be.
It started with casual Fridays for office workers, but 2 decades on, pretty much all workers want to wear what they want to wear. Kathleen Snyder is with Strategic HR, Inc.
They don't want to have to wear business suits, and they don't want to have to wear more formal business attire to work. And so it became a need of a lot of businesses to be able to adapt to that if they wanted to attract the right people.
Sam Walton originally had his workers wear khakis. That's what his customers were wearing in the 1950s, and he wanted to make the customers feel comfortable. That's evolved. Now Walmart's new dress code allows employees to wear solid shirts of any color and even blue jeans. That's to make the employees feel good. And in a tight labor market, companies need to do anything they can to attract workers. Abe Rutchick, a professor who's written about the psychology of how workers dress, says clothes affect how you act.
Wearing clothing that looks nice and makes people feel good is going to make them probably perform better.
Walmart says they're testing this out in less than 24 stores and that they're always testing new concepts. Terry Dunn is a union organizer. He's interested in the working conditions for Walmart workers. Standing in a parking lot of a Dallas store, he tells me dress codes really aren't at the top of the list of Walmart workers' concerns. That'd be better pay. And as a shopper himself, he says,
it wouldn't matter to me what they're wearing as long as the job performance and the customer service is there.
Walmart's new dress code isn't a total relaxed fit. Face tattoos, still not allowed. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
A little bit of agita in stocks today, bonds as well. And you know what that means, right? You do, don't you? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometimes you go on a reporting trip, you got a plan for what you're going to do, and then circumstances change your mind. That's what happened to Lizzie O'Leary, the host of Marketplace Weekend, who's in Puerto Rico to follow up on some reporting she did late last year. She had a plan, and then the lights went out, literally, everywhere. They are back, and Lizzie is on the line. Hey, Lizzie, how are you?
Hi, Kai. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm well. Listen, first of all, tell me where you are, and second of all, what's the deal with the power, the latest you got?
I'm in Toa Baja, which is about 15 miles outside San Juan. It was an area that was really hard hit by Hurricane Maria. You can probably hear behind me there's some rain. We're at a FEMA and Small Business Administration site. We just talked to the mayor here. This place is running on generators, though power had been back in Toa Baja until yesterday. It's pretty much returned to the island. One of the hard things is getting accurate information. It kept coming in and out around our hotel last night, but it seems to be coming back as far as we can tell and as far as the electric company says.
So you were in Toa Baja, I guess, when you were there in November. What's changed in the, what is it, six, almost 7 months now?
There's a lot less debris. Some of the stoplights are working. There, you know, are more signs of life, more open businesses. But you can still tell that a major hurricane came through here. A lot of blue tarps still for roofs. This was an area that was also flooded pretty heavily from the river nearby. So they've got a long way to go.
Can you get a cup of coffee and a loaf of bread and go to the market?
Yes and no. It depends on where you are. We checked back in with a convenience store owner, and, you know, he's put about $75,000 of his own money into his store. But he does have supplies, slowly.
Okay, so before the power went out, you're originally going to go down there and report on, at least part of the reporting was going to be schools and education. What's going on with that on that island?
So there's a plan from the governor and the education secretary to close 283 schools here. They say it's largely because of population declines, both before the storm, because of the debt crisis, and after the storm. There's also a bill to convert some of the schools into charters and offer some vouchers. As you can probably guess, a lot of the parents and certainly the teachers' unions are not happy. We went to a protest at JFK Elementary School here in Toa Baja, which is slated to be closed.
Who's Julia? What are they saying?
Yeah, Julia is Julia Kelleher. She's the Secretary of Education. So that was teachers and kids, you know, little second graders marching around with signs. They're talking about Julia Kelleher, and I interviewed her, basically said, look, you are putting forth this fairly aggressive plan. A lot of people are not happy with it. What do you say to them, and kind of how do you move forward? And here's what she had to say.
We haven't bought books in probably 8 years. My kids don't have access to technology. So in order to be able to make that kind of investment and purchase the materials that they need, and in order to be able to pay teachers a better salary, they haven't gotten a pay raise in 10 years. I mean, part of this adjustment is to be able to serve other purposes, right? It's not just consolidating for the sake of consolidating. This is about a strategic use of the dollars that are available and a disciplined approach to reinvesting so that we can get better outcomes, because that's really the end game.
What are the odds, Lizzie? What are the odds that they get those outcomes?
I think they're probably going to get them, but it's not going to be an easy process. One of the things that the mayor of Toa Baja told me, and I've seen this again and again, is nobody trusts anybody right now. And there are a lot of extremely difficult conversations that are happening. And it's really hard to do that when you have a massive trust deficit.
Yeah, I bet. So listen, really quickly, I heard you on the morning show with David Brancaccio this morning talking about your interview with Governor Ricardo Rossello. What does he have to say about, I don't know, like the next 6, 8, 10 months on that island?
I think he wants to do something that I've heard from several people in power, which is sort of reinventing Puerto Rico. More than one person has used the New Orleans post-Katrina analogy with me. And that's a complicated analogy. One thing that is still hanging over this is we don't know exactly what the bankruptcy judge who was overseeing the island's bankruptcy is going to say about this, and the oversight board, which looks at Puerto Rico's financial statements. And in that respect, it's really hard to say who's in charge. Governor Roselló can say he wants a lot of things, but if the oversight board says, we don't like this plan, then tough.
Right. Liz Uhler, the host of our weekend show on the ground in Toa Baja, Puerto Rico, for us. More reporting, this weekend on the show, or are you going to wait and do it next weekend?
Next weekend.
Next weekend. All right. Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks, Kai.
There are few cities in this economy that have been hit harder by, basically by everything than Detroit has been the past couple of decades. It's coming back, Detroit is for sure, but there are some overhanging issues to deal with, including something like 20,000 abandoned homes. A new city-sponsored program is working to repopulate some of those properties by essentially giving them to families living near a big bridge construction zone. WDET's Laura Herberg explains.
Maria Wachenbach lives with her four dogs just around the corner from the construction site for the Gordie Howe Bridge that goes to Canada. She's been here in the home she inherited from her mother-in-law for almost 20 years.
My husband actually passed away in this home. So there's a lot of memories in this home. And now that I'm looking to retire in another year or two, I want to start fresh.
So Wachenbach signed up to participate in the first round of the city's home swap program.
This is the website. Have you seen this?
She scrolls through photos of 10 homes the city of Detroit acquired after the previous owners stopped paying taxes. The city is responsible for 30,000 such structures. Those available for the home swap program look dilapidated, but the city will renovate them for up to $75,000 in exchange for eligible homes. Wachenbach has her eye on a little brick house a few miles away.
It's a 3-bedroom, 1-bath home. And I love it because it has a humongous backyard with 2 trees my grandboys can climb.
The home swap program, as well as jobs and health monitoring, came out of a community benefits agreement that people living near the bridge site lobbied for. Home swap director Charity Dean says renovation costs are being paid for by the sale of city-owned land that the state needed in order to build the bridge.
The city was originally offered, you know, $200,000 for the land, and the mayor turned that into a $45 million package.
Residents fought for a program like HomeSwap so there'd be an option for people who didn't lose their homes to eminent domain, but who didn't want to stay in the increasingly industrialized area. Due to the renovation price limit, the program makes the most sense for families that can fit in modest-sized homes. In order to participate, homeowners need to be up to date on the water bills and property taxes for the home they'd be giving up. And that's been hard for some.
Ostensibly, those are reasonable requirements, but it's just complicated.
That's Michelle Oberholzer. She's a director at the local nonprofit United Community Housing Coalition. Oberholzer says initially more than 50 interested families were ineligible for the program.
It's difficult to get someone to pay out for something that they're then going to leave behind.
Since then, most of those families have resolved their tax and water bill issues. But Oberholzer says she hopes the city will work to find solutions for the handful who haven't. Resident Maria Wachenbach says she believes staying on top of her taxes enabled her to be one of the first people approved for HomeSwap. And that helped her to get the little 3-bedroom she'd been eyeing. Today, she's on the final walkthrough before signing the papers to initiate the swap. Inside, there's caution tape over the windows, paint chips hang from the ceiling, and there's a hole in a wall. City housing specialist Antoine Hayes tells Wachenbach that when she comes back and it's all renovated,
You're probably going to cry.
Just the thought of getting a house is unbelievable. See, you got me crying now.
The renovations are supposed to take 6 to 9 months. After Wachenbach moves in, her home near the bridge is scheduled to be demolished. The city hopes to recruit and relocate 240 families. In Detroit, I'm Laura Herberg for Marketplace.
Coming up,
business revolves around the royal family and the royal positioning in town.
Nobody's above cashing in on Harry and Meghan, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. Dow Industrial's off 83 points today, about 0.3%, 24,664. NASDAQ gave back 57 points, about 0.7%, 72.38. The S&P 500 down 15.5%, 26.93. Procter & Gamble dropped 3.2% today. The U.S. firm agreed to buy the consumer health business of German drug maker Merck for more than $4 billion. Merck up 18.5%. Thank you very much. Banks moved higher in line with rising bond yields. Bank of America deposited 2.2% today. Citigroup bustled up 1.8%. Philip Morris International dropped 15.5% today. Tobacco company reported worse than expected first quarter revenue as global smoking rates decline. Bond prices, well, they fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note. When that happens, it goes up 2.91%. You're listening to Marketplace. Just as you count on Marketplace for reliable, in-depth news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across this country. You'll reap the rewards every time you listen, knowing that you're helping Marketplace make people smarter about the economy and why it matters. And don't forget, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar when you give today, thanks to a generous challenge from our friends at Candida. Now's the time, folks. Go to Marketplace.org and make a gift to become a Marketplace investor today. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's some research out today about the American housing market, rental housing in particular, in the past 10, maybe 15 years in this economy, and how, yes, here it comes, the rent is too darn high. But more to the point, what exactly that means for the millions of Americans in that slice of this housing market. Aaron Currier directs the Financial Security and Mobility Project at Pew Charitable Trusts, whence the research comes. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What has happened to renters in this economy since, say, the middle to the end of the Great Recession?
Well, what we are looking at here with our latest report is that 43 million U.S. households now rent their homes. And that's a figure that has been growing a lot in recent years. But as it has grown, the proportion of renters who struggle with rent has also grown.
Talk to me for a second about that phrase you just zipped by us, rent burdened. What does that mean?
Yeah, we're measuring people as being rent burdened if they have a rental cost equal to or greater than 30% of their income. So that's a big portion of households' income going to rent.
Why has this happened? I get that that's like a PhD level question, but give me the radio answer.
Sure. So between 2001 and 2015, demand for rental properties skyrocketed, and that drove prices to historic highs. And that's in part because fewer people are transitioning to home ownership. It's also because of demographic shifts. Like, for example, more older Americans are renting. But just since 2004, there's been an increase of 9.3 million new renter households.
Wow. I mean, that's a bunch. But then that plays into the supply-demand equation, right? If there are these many more rental households and X number of multifamily dwellings, that's a problem.
Exactly. But it's also coupled with the fact that over the same time period, income really hasn't grown mm-hmm. that much. And mm-hmm. so you've got rents going up with incomes remaining pretty flat, and that really puts a pinch on household balance sheets.
So if you define rent burdened as more than 30% of income, my guess is that there are families out there paying 60%, 70%. Maybe what is life like for the families in that kind of jam?
They're financially precarious in other ways. So nearly two-thirds of rent-burdened households have less than $400 in a bank account. Mm. And the typical rent-burdened household only has $10 in savings. And just to put that in perspective—
Wait, say that again. $10?
Yep, $10 in savings, while the typical homeowner has $7,000. This research also shows that people who are rent-burdened are just not able to transition to home ownership. And if they're not transitioning to homeownership at the same rate that they used to, there's clearly something going on. And it's problematic, not just for families, but for communities and all the way up to the national economy.
You alluded to the national economy for a minute. Take a step back from your data and help us understand what this situation, this rent burden population and their difficulties, what does that mean for the national economy?
Right. Well, there's so much good research that shows that households that are able to own their home are building wealth. At a micro level, if you're spending 30, 40 or 50% of your income just on shelter, you're barely able to afford food and transportation, other core needs, let alone put together a nest egg or contribute to the growth of the economy more broadly.
Would we have been here to some varying degree, even without the financial crisis? What difference did the financial crisis make in this situation, I guess, is the question.
Yes. I mean, we're looking all the way back to 2001. Yeah. Much of our research has shown that the recession absolutely put a spotlight on financial vulnerability, but it didn't really necessarily have a fundamental impact in how people were saving or how their wealth was being driven over the long haul when you look, you know, across multiple decades.
Erin Currier, she's the director of the Financial Security and Mobility Project at Pew Charitable Trusts, a new paper out on the rent burden population in this country and what it means. Erin, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
There are two big events on the British calendar over the next year or so. The end of March 2019, when the United Kingdom is going to be out of the European Union. Brexit is, of course, the term. The other is coming up more quickly, a month from today. In fact, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle getting married in St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle, out about 22 miles west of central London. The bells of St. George's will chime on the day, but as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, the cash registers in town are already ringing.
In their scarlet tunics and bearskin hats, the Coldstream Guards march down the hill alongside Windsor Castle, their black boots and brass trombones gleaming in the sunshine. But don't be fooled by the pomp and pageantry. This is business.
That's what the fabric of the town is. Business revolves around the royal family and the royal positioning in town. It all revolves around that.
Deputy leader of the local council, Phil Bicknell, says tourism is by far the town's biggest industry. Thanks to the royals, 7 million visitors flock to Windsor every year. An extra 100,000 are expected on the wedding day. And with dollar signs in his eyes, Bicknell anticipates a big influx of free spenders from the US.
The Americans are very keen that they're going to get into the royal family at last. They must be over the moon that at last they're going to get some American blood into the royal family.
Of course, another American divorcee, Mrs. Simpson, stormed the ramparts of the British monarchy 80 years ago. But since that ended in an abdication, no one in Windsor wants to dwell on it today. They're too busy making money.
And I will give you your change. Your receipt and your change. Thank you. Have a good day.
Here in the King and Queen gift shop at the foot of Castle Hill, Harry and Meghan memorabilia have been flying off the shelves. Fridge magnets, T-shirts, tea towels and mugs bearing images of the happy couple and costing $18 or more. Here I bumped into a British customer, Margaret Tyler, adding to her collection of royal souvenirs.
I've got about 10,000, but
10,000
in my house. Yes. I've got no room to move hardly. I've got a settee, a television, a little kitchen. I haven't got anything else.
You're a monarchist then?
Something like that. Yeah. I'm so excited about the royal wedding. I can't wait.
The wedding has triggered an avalanche of royal tat, including some bizarre items like the Harry and Meghan breakfast cereal. But bobbing on the tide of totally forgettable memorabilia, there's one item that's attracted much attention, a plate bearing the image of Meghan and this well-known redhead. She played the fiddle in an Irish band, but she fell in love with an Englishman. Yes, the English pop star Ed Sheeran. They got the wrong redhead. Lucy Bryant of Modern Chintz, who made the plate, says she made the mistake on purpose.
I wanted to have a plate that would just make people giggle if they got the joke.
Her inspiration was a mug commemorating the wedding of Prince William that bore a picture of Harry by mistake. Her joke is paying off. The plate is selling fast and at $35 a pop, even though this isn't quite in the spirit of a royal wedding.
Can we deduce from this plate, Lucy, that you're not a fan of the monarchy?
Well, yes, you can deduce that. I don't really feel that they have a place in our modern society.
You're not excited about the royal wedding, then?
The short answer is no.
But you are going to cash in on it.
I am indeed, and that makes me very happy.
Her happiness might be short-lived if the royal legal crockery begins to fly, if, say, there are legal problems over using Meghan's image. But Lucy Bryant is planning a preemptive peace offering to the couple, her plate as a wedding present. In Windsor, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I honestly think might turn out to be the salvation of all humanity, or at least salvation for the millions of us who have lost countless hours of our lives putting together IKEA furniture. Scientists in Singapore have programmed a robot to assemble said furniture, 20 minutes start to finish for an IKEA chair. Of course, it did take them 3 years to write the program for the thing. Okay, got to go. Dow Industrials off 83 points today, about 0.3%. NASDAQ down 57, about 0.7%. S&P 500 gave back 15 points, 0.5% there. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.